I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Jamie Stillings. His new book is called The Bridge at Hoover Dam, published by Nasraeli Press. It's a gigantic book of photographs. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
This is, I think, perhaps the largest format book of photographs I've ever seen. It's about, as the title suggests, this bridge built at Hoover Dam. How did you come to start photographing it?
In early 2009, I went on a road trip. It was a slow time at the studio, and I wanted to get out and exercise my photographic eyes. So we headed west towards the Mojave Desert, and on the way crossed Hoover Dam, a place I had not been to since I was a child, and encountered the bridge for the first time. So it was at that moment that it captivated me.
I noticed, looking at the book, that you weren't there from the beginning, so I figured it wasn't like an assignment where they said, we want you to document this from the time the first little piece of rock is moved out of the canyon wall. But you did get there in time to see this amazing moment, which is, I mean, the structural basis of the bridge is this huge concrete arch, and the way they build these things, they build it from each side and the arch meets in the middle.
I'm certain that if I had not encountered the bridge at the time that I did, with the arches starting across the canyon towards a rendezvous over the Colorado River, I might have driven right past. It was definitely an adopted project. We arrived there at dusk on the evening of March 4th and saw what happened as twilight came and the construction lights came up, and it was at that moment we decided to spend an extra day. After having spent that day and photographing the bridge at dusk the following evening, I made a decision, really. How could I document this bridge? How could I document this object growing across a canyon, this consummate intersection of the human-made object with nature? And so I approached the New York Times Magazine with a group of images, feeling that an editorial approach might be a way to gain access to the project.
And you indeed, it was actually good timing because they were ready for a project of that nature because they were focusing on infrastructure in the U.S.
As it turned out, their architectural issue, scheduled for 3 months later, was going to be on infrastructure in the United States in all its realms. And, of course, traditional highway infrastructure was a part of that. It was a very thin magazine at that point in time, being the recession of 2009. So I got a letter of assignment, a small guarantee for first rights, and off I went. But it was that letter of assignment that gave me initial access to the Federal Highway Administration and to the Bureau of Reclamation, the two agencies I really needed to be in touch with and gain access through to begin photographing the bridge.
Now, were you able to talk to the engineers and the people building it and gain a kind of physical understanding of what was happening? I mean, physics understanding?
Definitely. I'm not by no means a bridge expert, but I know a lot more about bridges now than I did then. And it was certainly through my own curiosity and through the access to the key management of Federal Highway Administration, who were overseeing the whole project, that I came to understand structurally how the bridge was being built and certain steps in its construction.
I guess when you build a bridge across a canyon like that, there are a number of choices on how to build. How did they choose that particular construction, the concrete arch?
The designer of the bridge, the chief bridge engineer David Goodyear, who is with T.Y. Lynn International, a company based out of San Francisco, first approached the canyon and saw Hoover Dam and saw the ruggedness of Black Canyon. And he really responded to the fact, I think initially, that the dam itself is an arch form. It holds the water back via reposed arch construction. His feeling intuitively was that an arch bridge was the logical response to act in complement to the dam. Knowing that in the back of his brain, however, he went through a number of iterations of different ways that bridges could be built across the canyon. And they essentially returned from both a cost standpoint and a practical construction standpoint to the arch form.
And the engineer talks a little bit in your book, I think, about the glorious union between nature and man-made structures. And how to make that work.
Well, there are a number of things. First of all, William Fox, who's a wonderful essayist, is the director of the Center for Art and the Environment at the Nevada Museum of Art, wrote an essay in the back of the book. And he talks about the arch form in nature, the arch as it is expressed through the dam and the arch as it came to be expressed through the bridge. From an engineering standpoint, that bridge could not have been built when the dam was built. So 75 years later, technology had advanced to the point where that became both practical and, in fact, the best option they considered it to be.
Why did they need a bridge at this particular moment in time? Well, how were people getting across before?
When the dam was first built, it was in the middle of nowhere. In fact, Boulder City, the closest town to the dam, was built specifically to house people that were going to build the dam. But over time, activity, commercial activity, tourist activity between Las Vegas and Phoenix picked up a lot. And in particular, the dam became a tourist site almost from the day it was completed. So that all of a sudden you had thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people visiting the dam every year. At this point in time, about 800,000 people visit the dam every year. So what happened was a little road that switchbacks down on the Arizona side, curves across the dam, and switchbacks up the Nevada side very quickly became inadequate for the amount of traffic. They put up with that for a long time, but for decades talked about building a bridge. When 2001 happened in the 9/11 events in New York and Washington, they decided to move all commercial traffic off the dam. And at that point in time, it amped up the need for the bridge. So they basically pulled out the options they'd been considering and made a decision to build a bridge within sight of Hoover Dam.
The bridge and your pictures of the bridge, for me, as I was looking at your book, call to mind, I guess, some kind of earlier 20th century era where there were a lot of photographers who glorified human-made engineering projects, the industrial age, and things like that. I mean, the sheer beauty and power of human beings' mark on the environment in that way and all of the possibilities inherent within that. And we're at such a different stage in our history right now where we see the horrors of the human mark on the environment. And there's a deep irony in the beauty of this bridge on the one hand and the potential failure of the entire Hoover Dam, because the lake, the reservoir, is going down to the point where the dam may become unviable because of climate change.
Well, to your first point, I think that you're correct. In the early part of the 20th century, there was still the capacity for awe. We stood in awe of the ability to create, construct large public works projects that were beyond the ability of us individually at the time to really comprehend. Now we're at a place where we understand the complexity of those, perhaps more fully than we did then. We look at them less naively.
We, the general public.
And as a consequence, if we're nuanced, we're looking at both the things that are positive about something like that, building a bridge, and the things that are negative at the same time, the things that are positive about a dam and negative about a dam. Certainly, the Southwest would not be what it is today without Hoover Dam.
Right.
Without the water that comes from the Colorado through the dam system on the Colorado River, without the hydroelectric power that goes as far as Los Angeles, as well as water going there. Whether or not we would be in better shape not having Hoover Dam, that's another question. I think that it's a mixed bag. It will always be a mixed bag, as we're starting to see with dam systems throughout the country. But still, there is this place to look at how we interact with nature. We are a people who build. We build systems. We build a society. We need to be conscious of what that means as we move forward. There is no project that we're going to build, whether it's a small house on a piece of property or a large public works project, that does not inherently involve things that are positive and things that are negative. It's how we weigh those two together, making the decision that's important.
We're talking to Jamie Stillings about his book, The Bridge at Hoover Dam. When I look at these photographs, and because the format of the book is so huge, and because of the angles at which you took the pictures, I get vertigo looking at some of them. What was it like to actually be on site taking these pictures? Were you there interacting with some of the bridge builders themselves?
First of all, once I gained access predominantly through Bureau of Reclamation, because they control all the land around Hoover Dam, secondarily through Federal Highway Administration, I did initial scouting to get a sense of where I might photograph in the future over a period of time. That gave me a familiarity. And in many ways, it was like witnessing a huge erector set being built. And it was all of the childhood plug-ins in terms of adrenaline rush, along with my love of mountain climbing and a whole range of things that came into play as I was out shooting. And perhaps knowing that I'm sitting on a ridge watching a certain point in construction of a bridge and knowing that that was transitory. It would be gone in a week. It would be gone after that night. When I came back 2 months later, it would be at a different place. The image would look different. The sun would be in a different place. That process of being aware of how I was moving through time with the bridge was very, very exciting. So I guess that's the best way I can describe it. It was very exciting, and at the same time it could be boring. I could be sitting there on a particular place for 2 or 3 hours hoping that something would happen, and it wouldn't.
When you sit there for 2 or 3 hours hoping that something's would happen, what are you hoping for? The sun to move in such a way that you have a different kind of light that gives you the drama you want, or what?
One of the things that I developed pretty early on was that my access was needed to be predetermined. So in order to get permissions, I needed to say, at this point in time, I want to be here. 2 hours later, I'd like to be here. Tomorrow morning, I'd like to be here. And I needed to get clearance for each one of those areas ahead of time. That meant that my conceptualization of how the bridge was evolving within Black Canyon needed to be three-dimensional. It needed to be fleshed out. I needed to understand what different viewpoints would look like. Then what I tried to do is evaluate where the sun was at a particular time of year, where the particular phase of construction was, and build a series of images that would over time create and amplify an essay about the bridge's construction. So it meant that I had to make an investment in a particular point of view. If I was going to be at a particular point that might have taken me an hour to get to, and I was going to track the light down for that evening, it also meant, from a permitting standpoint, I had what I kindly call minders with me, but they're basically people from the Bureau of Reclamation or Federal Highway Administration who were along with me. And in the case of Bureau of Reclamation, that cost me an hourly fee as part of my location fee. So I knew that if I was out for a few hours in the evening, it might cost me $200-$400. I better come back with a photograph.
Now, there were two parts to this whole project. The first one was for the New York Times, and then the second part was this book, which basically gave you more independence than doing a magazine piece.
One of the things that I felt about the New York Times was they support a range of aesthetics within photography. And they did indeed create the initial access for me, but also I felt freedom within that process to initiate an essay. When it came out in June of 2009, I made a decision to consider, or to continue the project rather, as a personal project. My feeling was that if I approached another magazine, another publication, they would start to dictate the storyline or the narrative. And I selfishly felt I wanted to determine that entirely myself. So fortunately, the initial access that I gained, I was able to continue and I could move forward. That initially was only meant to develop out the photographic essay. Whether it was going to be a book or an exhibition was unclear at that point, only that I needed to continue moving forward with photographing. The more time I invested in the project, the more expense I invested in that, it became clear that it was going to be a larger body of work, that it had aesthetic merit, hopefully, but also historic merit, in that the way that we remember other construction works like Hoover Dam is predominantly through the photography that was taken during its construction. That forms our historic memory. So if I could do a good job documenting the bridge as it was being built, that might serve as an historic document as well as an aesthetic interaction with a man-made structure as it evolved across a canyon.
There are some pictures of the dam, and I was thinking, why is this picture in here? And then I realized that there's a shadow of the bridge on the dam, which amplifies this whole idea of the bridge really being constructed in a way that went aesthetically with the dam.
There's one image in the book in particular that's shot over the top of the dam that forms an oval or shows an oval of the arches between the dam and the bridge itself. And the image that I think you're referring to is right near the end of the book. About a year earlier, I had looked from the river level at the shadow of the then-evolving bridge against the dam in the late afternoon, and I said to myself, I'd like to come back someday and photograph the shadow of this bridge connecting up with the dam. I calculated that out again, looking at the path of the sun at a particular time of year, and as it happened, I was on a month on the other side of the winter solstice instead of the month on the front side of the winter solstice, really about this time. I was there about 10 months ago. What I did then is on the ground the first day, I tracked the shadow of the bridge as it moved up from the canyon level and did a series of photographs that way. So I knew exactly what time I needed to be in the air. Then I rented a helicopter and made sure that I was over the dam and the bridge at that particular point in the afternoon 2 days later. That image, the image of just a shadow curving across the front face of Hoover Dam, to me is very much a metaphoric image. It's a connective image. It was taken 5 minutes before the end of the entire project.
Is that right?
It was at the very end before the helicopter and I went back towards the airport. And I like it because it establishes that connection that now is permanent between the bridge and Hoover Dam without overtly showing the bridge.
Right, exactly. We're talking to Jamie Stillings. What was the actual work like for the workmen who were building this? I mean, there's pictures of people with hard hats and there's a lot of night pictures. Was this a round-the-clock project?
I'm going to answer that two different directions. First of all, it was a very difficult construction project. The workers, the iron workers and the others out on the bridge were subject to extremes in heat, in wind. It was a 24-hour-a-day project during significant portions of it, especially during the construction of the arch. So these guys were out there day in, day out, really pushing through sometimes temperatures that are 120 degrees in the canyon, plus the humidity and exothermic heat coming off newly poured concrete. So very challenging conditions for them. Because of the nature of my access, I was not able to spend time right around the workers. That was one of the sacrifices, one of the things that I didn't give up exactly. I just simply was not able to gain that access. So it meant that the way that I documented the bridge had to include the human figure, but without the human voice specifically in the project. The bad news is there's a series of portraits that I wish I could have taken of the very specific people who built the bridge that I'll never be able to take.
You mean you weren't allowed to talk to them, to photograph them?
I was not given access to be out on that construction site and to be working in that capacity.
Yeah.
The nature of my access was to be able to photograph the bridge within the landscape. And if I wanted to keep that access, in particular through the Federal Highway Administration, I needed to kind of follow their guidelines of what I could do and what I couldn't do. There were reasons perhaps behind that. I don't agree with those reasons, but I try to understand them. The project was a partnership of multiple federal agencies, multiple state agencies, private contractors, and unions. So there were a lot of parties that had come together to build the bridge and the Hoover Dam bypass. I think the feeling of the project manager was that his job was to build a bridge, And he didn't want anything to get in the way of that in terms of politics or egos or anything else. He was concerned that were I to be in there in the mix of things, aside from potentially posing a safety risk to somebody or something, that I might impose some type of politic or interaction in there that he thought would be counterproductive.
Right.
I don't think that would have been the case. I've spent significant time on other construction sites. I would have loved to do that particular body of work. At the end of the day, I know that the gift that came out of that is that the landscape work that I did, the focus specifically on the bridge within the landscape, is a deeper body of work because I was unable to do the other two bodies of work that I had considered.
That's interesting. That's a nice way of looking at it. But let's talk about the nighttime pictures, because there's quite a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Were you up there at 4 a.m.? I mean, what was this like for you?
In the middle of summer, we were often working till 11 or 12 at night and would be out again at 3 in the morning to get into location for a dawn shot. So the worst times, of course, were end of June and beginning of July when the days were longest. And yes, we wanted to take advantage of nighttime and dawn. For me, I think the initial attraction of the bridge was that the mix of ambient light and construction light, in particular when the transition happened from daytime to nighttime. It took on a magical quality, took on a cinematic quality, something that we weren't used to seeing. And so it would stop me, as well as it stopped other people, to see the huge amount of light being poured onto this bridge at night so that they could work 24 hours a day.
Right.
And
which is just lit up in the pictures in your book.
And there are many things that happen in that process, too. As a photographer, what I'm trying to do is balance the ambient light or the daytime light with the construction light. And so there's a magic point where those two cross each other. And at that point in time, you get the optimal detail of detail in the canyon, of detail in the highlights from the construction lights, and you're trying to bring it together in a way that can communicate as effectively as possible. But there were things that helped me that were completely serendipitous. For instance, the cables, the cable stays that held the arch segments up as the arch was growing across the canyon before it was connected. Those are black cables, but they were shrouded in white tubing because of the heat of the sun. Had they not been, the cables would be constantly shrinking and expanding, make it very difficult, if not impossible, to get the two arch segments to meet up in the center. So because they were sheathed, that meant that at night they were visible against the night sky. Many things like that contributed to making that particular essay what it is today, though I had no control over them.
Does it feel like a narrative to you, this book?
Very much. Though I did not encounter the bridge at the beginning of construction, I encountered it at a point in time that I felt was the most interesting from a visual standpoint, from a narrative standpoint. And I loved the process of watching that arch evolve and then become a bridge. I also knew photographically that every time I photographed it a certain way, that was it. It would be gone. When I come back 2 months later or even 2 weeks later, that particular point would be gone forever.
Yeah.
So that I had to depend on the success of each particular visit to build that narrative over time. And ironically, the closer the bridge came to completion, the harder it was to photograph, because the closer it came to being something that we understand. We understand what an arch bridge looks like. It's a bridge. It's immediately understandable by us, whereas something that's supported by cables that's starting to move across a canyon to eventually meet in the center of it is something we don't understand. At least the average person rarely gets to see something like that.
And if you're driving across it, you don't even really see the arch. You're not even cognizant of it. You're on a straight line of road, and that's it.
That's exactly true. If somebody goes to the bridge today, the drive-across experience is a non-experience. They made the concrete barriers at a height that passenger cars cannot see over the edge.
Oh, so you can't even look out the passenger window and see the river or anything?
No, you need to be in a pickup truck or a truck or a bus to see something like that. However, what you absolutely should do is to get off on the Nevada side, drive back towards Hoover Dam, and there is a parking lot there. You can park in that parking lot and walk across the bridge. The pedestrian side of the bridge faces Hoover Dam, and it is an amazing view. It's a view of Hoover Dam that was never around prior to the construction of the bridge. Even to fly in a helicopter, you would probably not fly that low, at least not safely. So it's a view that's unique to the 80-year history of Hoover Dam since the beginning of its construction. The converse is that if you want to get a sense of the bridge, you really need to be on the dam looking back towards the bridge.
Right.
And it's an amazing sight to see, though I have to say that the points of view that I was able to collect over a period of 2 years are not ones that are accessible to the average person. And so, therefore, that particular set of perspectives is best viewed through the book.
Right, exactly. Now, tell us about the name of the bridge.
The bridge's official name is the Mike O'Callaghan Pat Tillman Memorial Bridge, a rather cumbersome name. It was designated that by Congress in 2004. Mike O'Callaghan was a very popular governor in Nevada, who later went on to be a newspaper editor, and very much a beloved citizen of Nevada. Pat Tillman is a name more familiar to most, a professional football player for the Arizona Cardinals, who made a decision to go and serve in the military after the 9/11 attacks and was killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan. So he is a second name attached to that bridge, and it's one, of course, from Nevada and one from Arizona. I think it's a cumbersome name. I think locals are probably calling it the Mike and Pat. It's a little bit easier to handle. For simplicity's sake, and to let people know, I've chosen to call it the bridge at Hoover Dam without any disrespect to either of the two men.
I notice that in the book there are a few what you might call nature photographs, landscape photographs that don't, unless I miss something, that don't have man-made structures in them. Is that right?
Yes.
And why did you decide to include those?
The bridge and the dam are major intrusions into nature and a part of the country that's very, very rugged. My feeling was to understand the landscape upstream, which now includes a mineral deposit stripe because the water level is lower in Lake Mead. And the reservoir itself, of course, is man-made, was one acknowledgement of what lies upstream. And downstream, once one goes past the construction of both the bridge and dam, you re-enter a part of the canyon which is basically untouched by man. And I wanted to acknowledge that connection. So for me, it is always about our interplay between us and nature. That is what the question is. And it's how we do it. It's where we do it. It's how we weigh the things that are positive against the things that are negative. And so I wanted to have that acknowledgement to nature in the book.
If you think about the mineral stripe around Lake Mead, in a way that is a man-made structure, given the way that we've been treating the environment.
Very much so. The mineral deposit striping comes, of course, from minerals that leach from rocks as they move down the Colorado River and then are sitting for a period of time in Lake Mead. The banding is a symbol that shows we're using water at a rate that is greater than the natural flow of the Colorado. That's because of the amount of water we're using both for urban development, the population that we have in the Southwest, and for agriculture.
Let's talk about the book itself. As we mentioned at the beginning of this program, it's a very big book. I don't even know what the dimensions are of it, but I had trouble getting it home. It's so big. It's not a thick volume, but there must have been quite a bit of decision-making that went into that. I imagine that the scale and grandness of those photos required a large format.
First of all, I'm not a photographer who believes in making something big just to make it big. As it turned out, this particular project, I felt, lent itself to a larger format book. I hoped that in a book format I might be able to convey some of the grandeur that I felt when I was standing on the edge of the canyon. When I met the eventual publisher of the book, Chris Pickler of Nazareli Press, he was really the one who immediately said, this is the size it needs to be. It is something I had only hoped for. I thought I might even have to self-publish the book. Chris looked at a few images at the Palm Springs Photo Festival last March and immediately said, this has got to be a large format book. His scale for that is 17 by slightly under 14 inches, so it's about 17 by 13 and a half inches. It's 128 pages. And because of the nature of the subject matter, I think it works well. The horizontal images are almost 24 inches across when you open the book up.
Right.
And so as a consequence, somebody can get that sense of awe that I felt when they look through the book. It's certainly a gift and a pleasure to be able to share the imagery in a book of that scale.
How did you begin to work with the essayist?
First of all, Chris of Nasraeli Press believes in keeping a book simple, distilled down to its essence. So we were on the same page from the onset in that. The second thing that we wanted to do was to avoid essays about the photography. My feeling very strongly is you respond to the photography how you respond to it. You might like it, you might not. You might love it, you might hate it. That's for you to decide, not for somebody to tell you. That being said, we wanted the voice of the chief bridge engineer, David Goodyear, since it was he who was responsible for that structure in its design. While the project was built by hundreds of people and huge teams on both government and private side, he was the one who conceptualized the shape of that, and I wanted his voice in there. I wanted to share a little bit about how I encountered the bridge and what the decisions were that led to me photographing it over a period of 2 years. And then the voice of William Fox, the director for the Center of Art and the Environment at the Nevada Museum of Art, is a wonderful essayist, and he chose, along with me, to develop an essay that is about the Colorado River, about the Black Canyon, about the dam and the bridge, and bringing it all together. In a way that I think is kind of delightful. It lets us celebrate the construction of the bridge, but within the context of nature. So those are very concise. They're there, along with a short piece from T.Y. Lin International, which is the firm that designed the bridge, and we were able to get some sponsorship support from them along the way, which we greatly appreciated.
We're talking to Jamie Stillings about his book, The Bridge at Hoover Dam. So there is a book signing at the Photo Eye Gallery this Saturday from 3 to 5 in the afternoon right here in Santa Fe.
Yes.
Will some of the pictures be on the walls?
I don't think we'll have any pictures on the wall. There's another show up or present. We might have a few images out. We'll have books out. And in the middle of the 3 to 5 time on Saturday afternoon, I'll give a short talk that'll be focused on the book itself and the evolution of the book, 10 or 15 minutes tops. But I'll be there to meet people and hopefully celebrate having a book out.
Now, you say that you do also have an exhibition of these photographs?
Yes, I built a traveling exhibition, which first was exhibited in Las Vegas in fall a year ago, and through the good graces of the Phoenix Art Museum, has been up since the 13th of August and will be at the Phoenix Art Museum through the 18th of December. So it's called the Bridge at Hoover Dam.
Just in case anybody happens to be passing through Phoenix.
Please check it out.
Where else will that exhibition be traveling?
I hope to travel it around the United States and ultimately overseas over the next several years. Its next stop is in Portland, Oregon in February at Blue Sky Gallery.
Jamie Stillings, I don't know your previous work. Is this a departure from what you've done before, this Hoover Dam project?
The answer is yes and no. My background is fine art and documentary work. I got a Master of Fine Arts in the early 80s. Having done my master's thesis in Nicaragua between the end of the Sandinista Revolution and the beginning of the Contra War, I evolved into...
Were you taking, like, war zone photographs?
Not
like
war
that?
Zone photographs. It's kind of period
right
of time
between
the two,
yeah.
When there was still a lot of hope, but also the beginning of disillusionment about what was possible to accomplish coming out of the revolution. Because I was not a war photographer in my heart and didn't feel that was a place that I could be, I evolved into the commercial world ostensibly to support personal projects. That came to dominate much of the last 28 years of my life until I encountered the Bridge at Hoover Dam, which was like a very large chiropractic adjustment photographically, because what it did was snap me back to where I really need to be as a photographer, as an artist. So that background that brought me to the Bridget Hoover Dam is both a documentary background and a commercial background. There are some roots there. There are some construction projects that I have photographed along the way. For instance, in the mid-90s, when I was still based in Rochester, New York, Bosch and Lomb built a new world headquarters, and I convinced them to support a documentary project where I had 24/7 access to a building being built in the center of Rochester. And so the ability to watch a structure evolve was very much in my DNA when I encountered the bridge at Hoover Dam.
Having been a commercial photographer for as long as you were, how did that affect your aesthetics? In other words, did it make the pictures stronger? Did you have to kind of undo some of your commercial way of looking?
What the commercial background did, I think, is two things predominantly. The first is that the technical ability to create a photograph and repeat that is extremely important in commercial work. So that technical ability could sit in the background for me when I was photographing at the bridge. Secondarily, the understanding that you need to bring a shot back. You have to work to bring something back. If it's gone, it's too late. That is a component of doing commercial work. That being said, the real joy for me was to place the requirements that a client dictates to a photographer in a commercial assignment of any type, to set that aside entirely. That's why I didn't go back to another form of editorial support. I wanted the absolute freedom to interact intuitively with this structure as it evolved in this canyon and have no other voices telling me what to do. So I think that it was really the antithesis for me of the commercial work. All the commercial work, all the fine art work, all the documentary work up to that point supported it, but ultimately it was creating a sense of freedom for me to simply interact on my own terms with that subject.
Jamie Stillings is a photographer. His new book is called The Bridge at Hoover Dam, published by Nezraeli Press. And once again, he will be doing a book signing at the Photo Eye from 3 to 5 this Saturday. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Megan Burns and Sean Diani. They are from Santa Fe Performing Arts and Meow Wolf, and they are presenting a play called Unit 113. It opens this coming weekend and runs for 2 weekends. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
So Meow Wolf is a wonderful organization, and Santa Fe Performing Arts that you are have been involved with, Megan, for quite a long time, mm-hmm. are getting together and doing something that involves, I think, young people.
Yes, it does. What we're doing this semester and hope to do more of in the future we are creating new plays with students. So we're taking, this semester we took their ideas, concepts, designs, and through mentorship and hands-on work, we created this script that Vince Kadalubek physically wrote based on their concepts. Sean did the set design and construction along with their help, and I'm directing this group of kids in this new play that we're creating.
What's it about?
It is set in a dystopian society, and there's a group of kids. They've been taken away from their parents. Their parents are deemed unfit for parenting, and they're put in this unit, 113, and they are assigned to guardians who are supposed to have parental attributes and also prepare them for the workforce. And through the story, there's one kid who sees things differently, and through that, the drama ensues.
So it's a kind of 1984 mm-hmm.
yeah,
Orwellian.
It's totally Orwellian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Totally.
Have the young people been reading Orwell in their classes?
I don't know that they have specifically this semester, but a lot of them have read it.
And so when you're working with these young playwrights and performers and so on, there must be some kind of borderline between how much you let them take over and how much direction you give them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, theater by its nature, it demands leadership, so it is really important to have leadership. You know, you have to get things done and things need to be orchestrated. But it's been amazing to work with the kids because they have so many ideas and they really, really want to get them out there. And that's like when you're dealing with an original play, I mean, that's super necessary. And then it's just about sort of putting those together. You know, with the set, it was about figuring out all the different elements that we needed to have and figuring out if we could have all of them fit on the stage. And, you know, we sort of had to adjust some things. And
what are some of the elements?
The central element is this gigantic machine, which the Guardians sort of plug into, and it involves like all these weird kind of pseudo mechanical parts and these kind of chairs that they sit on with these helmets that they put on. The kids made these really awesome helmets out of Instamorph and paper mache and stuff. And it's got little light up elements and a glowing orb above it. So it's this kind of like, it's sort of like Metropolis kind of machine. It's really cool.
Now, does it have a little bit of that scavenged meow wolf aesthetic?
Yeah, totally. One of the students in the class, her dad runs a couple auto shops in town.
Oh, nice.
So we got to go and scavenge some things from there, and just lots of recycled cardboard and reused materials from old Meow Wolf shows and things like that.
So. Have the kids seen any of the work that you guys have done? Meow Wolf?
A lot of the kids saw the Do Return over the summer, and they were really excited to work with us because of that show in particular. Some of them have seen previous shows. A couple of them may have seen The Moon Is to Live On, but it was mostly the Do Return.
Oh, okay. I mean, there were some young people who participated in The Moon Is to Live On as well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in particular a person playing a piece of bacon.
Yes, yeah. And she's actually in Unit 113.
Is she?
Yeah,
yes,
she is.
She was so cute.
She's now a Guardian, Sierra McDowell.
Yeah.
Ah, very interesting. One of the things that was so interesting about the play The Moon Is to Live On is that the story was only part of what made the play good. What really made it good was how it was told and the way that you used technology and cell phones and the way these phantasmagoric figures were walking around on the stage with their cameras and so on. It was just fascinating, and I wondered if you'd carried any of that kind of process into this play.
I think we have less of the otherworldly sort of dreamy aspects in this show. I think that we stressed the importance of story and character and arc and resolution and conflict with the students. And so this one is more of a straightforward theatrical piece, which is more concerned about the characters rather than the amazing technological aspects that we're capable of and all of that.
Right. So, and you're teaching them something which is very important, which is the nature of drama and getting that across.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a good place to start, a good foundation for the kids to understand, and then we can start, you know, breaking those rules and going really crazy with them in the future.
So this is part of a whole, before we went on the air, we were talking about sort of the layers of organizations. I mean, it's Santa Fe Performing Arts and Meow Wolf. It's also Chimera. What is Chimera? That's part of the collaboration.
Chimera is a new outreach and education program. It's an arts education program that's being presented by Meow Wolf and CCA. And we are, the core of our programming is to teach about collaboration through art making, but collaboration as an idea is really what's at the base of it. And so this is something that sort of Meow Wolf has been doing amongst itself, and of course it's a large sort of nebulous organization that includes lots and lots of people, but now through Chimera, with the help of CCA, we've been going into schools and teaching in elementary schools around town. And the program that Megan and Vince and I are doing with Santa Fe Performing Arts, you know, sort of fits in with that idea. So it's something that we want to continue and hopefully bring more Chimera instructors, who are also Meow Wolf members, into the process of creating theater with kids.
We're talking to Sean Diani and Megan Burns from Santa Fe Performing Arts and Meow Wolf. What is Meow Wolf up to these days?
Right now, Meow Wolf, there are about 9 to 12 people right now living in Las Cruces, New Mexico, working with NMSU and a lot of their arts students and graduate students on a show called Glitteropolis. And that opens November 30th, Wednesday.
In Las Cruces.
In Las Cruces.
Are you going to have like a charter bus?
I wish.
I wish too.
I know, I really wish. Yeah. Who knows? It's open.
It's open into February. I can't remember when it closes.
Is it an exhibition or also a play?
It's an art installation.
It's an installation.
Yeah. So that's where a lot of us have been and are right now.
Some people have been living down there for about a month, and some of us have been sort of traveling down when we can get down there to work on this crazy, glittery, colorful show at the NMSU Art Gallery.
That's so great. I love that the collective or the collaborative or whatever it's called is so kind of strong and sizable at this point, that you can have multiple projects going on at once and that you kind of have an aesthetic identity and are still growing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really exciting for us. I mean, it's been great to be, I haven't been able to be down in Las Cruces as much, but it's been great to still be involved in Chimera in town and still be working with, you know, with other Meow Wolfers doing interesting things in town while there's this whole other project going on down in Las Cruces. So yeah, I think we are kind of maturing into something that can successfully manage kind of multiple projects within a similar kind of attitude.
Yeah.
Any plans for the new year?
Oh yeah, we have some things up our sleeves.
Yes.
Ah, and we'll get back to you on the details.
Yes.
But yes,
the sleeves will be revealed.
We have really big sleeves.
We are planning in our big sleeves.
Megan Burns and Sean Diani are with Santa Fe Performing Arts and Meow Wolf, and the play Unit 113 opens this Friday at the Armory for the Arts. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Fridays and Saturdays at 7, Sundays at 2, and it's this weekend and next weekend. For more information, you can call the box office at 505-984-1370. Sean and Megan, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.